So here we are in year 13 of, you know, This Week in Startups. And I'm like, I want to do more of these like business breakdowns with Lon because they're fun for us to do and the audience loves them. So here we are. Resiliency is the big takeaway for me, grinding it out.
And just that understanding of branding from such an early, like today we take that for granted. Everybody is, we're all personal brands. Everybody thinks in that, in those terms. But in 1954, to be like, you know what? Those golden arches in every town, you'll be on the road and you'll drive and you'll know what that is. And you'll it's going to be consistent everywhere I go. McDonald's is McDonald's. Like, no, he was way ahead of the curve
way in
thinking about how important that would become for Americans.
This Week in Startups is brought to you by Curotech. Are you one of those companies that knows you need to be using AI, but you're not even sure where to start? Well, then you need Curotech. They are AI experts, and they're offering Twist listeners an AI strategy roadmap tailored to your business for $5,000. That's 50% off the normal cost just for telling them we sent you. Check out curotech.com/twist and get $5,000 off. Northwest Registered Agent. When starting your business, it's important to use a service that will actually help you. Northwest Registered Agent is that service. They'll form your company fast, give you the documents you need to open a business bank account, and even provide you with mail scanning and a business address to keep your personal privacy intact. Visit northwestregisteredagent.com/twist to get a 60% discount on your next LLC. And Masterworks is the first company allowing investors exposure into the blue chip artwork asset class. Twist listeners can skip the waitlist by going to masterworks.com/twist.
All right, everybody, welcome back to This Week in Startups. We've got another business breakdown for you today. You may remember Lon Harris and I on episode 1773. That's the episode number, not the year. We reviewed an incredible film, BlackBerry, and we broke down the major business lessons from it. You went crazy for this. We made clips. People went crazy on TikTok about it. So since we got so much great feedback, Lon and I, who are huge fans of cinema, decided we would do another one for you here in the holiday season. While you're on your break, you get to dive into the story of Ray Kroc taking over McDonald's. The movie is called The Founder. It came out in 2016. Nobody saw it, but Lon and I both love this film. We're going to go through the plot. We're going to pause during the plot to highlight and explain the major business lessons with some real-world examples that we as founders and just human beings on planet Earth trying to reconcile entrepreneurship and capitalism and its impact on society and why it's done so many great things. But also, hey, this is a perfect story to talk about the underbelly of capitalism as well, the sharp elbows and all that great stuff. And at the end, we'll do some award categories and recommendations like we did last time. Lon and I love movies. I love Lon. He's one of my favorite human beings on the planet. Great to be with you again, Lon.
So the film right now on Amazon Prime, Freevee. It's actually on the Freevee part of Amazon Prime. So you'll see a few ads, not too cumbersome, but it's there if you want to watch it. And from this point on, we're going to have spoilers. So if you have not yet seen The Founder, pause this, go watch The Founder. It's on Freevee. It's free.
Free.
And then come back
pretty
here.
Good price.
We're going to talk about it. You literally can't do better than that. It is free.
Spoiler alert. At some point, they make the Filet-O-Fish.
we don't care. That'll be the sequel. We'll get
That'll
into
be the sequel to
the
this
McRib
episode.
And the Filet-O-Fish. No post-credit scene where they tell them about the McRib initiative.
All right. So give us the quick hits. You're such a fan of films. Give us a quick hit. So who's in this? Who directed it? You know, give us the biography here.
Yeah. So this is a guy named John Lee Hancock who directed. He did not write the script. This was a script. I think it was a blacklist script. It was, the blacklist. They have those, like, every year they publish a list of the most popular, the most well-liked unproduced screenplays that were distributed that year. In 2015, I believe, or 2014, this script was one of those ones that was just a guy wrote it on spec based on Ray Kroc's biography, and it was floating out there looking for a director until John Lee Hancock came in. He also made The Blind Side with Sandra Bullock, that Oscar-winning film that has since been sort of questioned the veracity of it. Saving Mr. Banks, that film about Walt Disney making a deal for the rights to Mary Poppins to adapt that.
Oh.
That's actually, I was thinking that would be another interesting movie for this segment because it's also about negotiation, business, making deals, and sort of these different parties that had very different takes on the same project and what to do with it. So it's kind of an interesting balance here. And then he just did one called The Little Things with Jared Leto and Denzel Washington, a serial killer thing a few years ago.
Got it. So he seems to have inspirational and business mixed into his biography or filmography.
Yeah, definitely an interest in deal making, how sort of business is done and how, you know, like kind of the impact of that on individual lives that are caught up in that sort of system. I think, you know, there are a lot of different sort of films he's made that have kind of takes on that. Michael Keaton obviously stars as Ray Kroc. You also get great character actors, Nick Offerman and John Carroll Lynch. They play Dick and Mac McDonald, the actual original creators of the very first McDonald's burger stand. Laura Dern plays Ray Kroc's wife, Ethel Kroc, and Linda Cardellini plays Joan Smith, who becomes his next wife. During the course of the film, we also see her perspective. Patrick Wilson plays her husband. They are early McDonald's franchise owners who have their own kind of way of doing business. So that's kind of the long and the short
also,
of the cast.
Written by Robert D. Siegel, who I looked up. He also did two films I very much enjoyed. There's one called Big Fan that was with Patton Oswalt. That's a very like Sundance-y kind of film, 500K.
Very dark comedy, but dark interesting. Comedy. But yeah.
And he also did The Wrestler, or wrote The Wrestler,
He wrote The Wrestler. I love that movie.
Yeah. He also, interestingly, worked in comedic writing. So he was a senior editor at The Onion from 1996 to 1999, and editor-in-chief from 1999 to 2003. So I thought that was also notable, the path of the screenplay writer. You and I are both writers.
Mm-hmm.
But so hard to make movies, huh? When you're a screenplay writer or a director, you work every 5 years or so on something.
One, I mean, I feel like this is clearly the sort of thing that comes from a veteran screenwriter because it takes so many sort of odd, unexpected turns. Like it's a format that we're very familiar with. The like, you know, person made good, Horatio Alger, rags to riches, the rise of this great brand. I mean, we had even a ton of those movies this year about the story behind all these famous brands. But this one takes a very different tack where it's like, it's very conflicted about the guy and what he has to do in order to succeed. Mm. And it neither completely trashes him and presents him as a monster, nor is it a hagiography that presents him as a saint-like great man. Usually a biopic, you're going to come down on one side or the other. Like Ray, the Ray Charles movie, great movie, not. But even when Ray Charles does things we recognize are not good or struggles, it's never like, well, Ray Charles wasn't a good guy. It's always like Ray Charles was a great guy. He was a troubled man. He had problems like everybody. This movie, I don't think is Ray Kroc was a great guy. He just had troubles. It's like, maybe Ray Kroc wasn't such a great guy. It's kind of asking you to make the decision about what kind of a guy he was and how early in the process did he make the decisions about what he was going to eventually do with this company. So we'll get more into that, but that's a very interesting screenwriting thing that I think this movie does that a lot of other movies would not do.
And I think the reason is if you were in Hollywood, correct me if I'm wrong, you're going for the biggest box office possible. And if it's a conflicted, complex character, maybe you don't feel as jazzed after watching it. Maybe you're not over the moon.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
So it would have been better to just, you know, sugarcoat the whole thing and make it like champagne and more exciting for
audiences
people.
Love rousing, inspirational biopics when it's something that's going to make you feel good and make you feel like, hey, this guy. And we were talking too. This is a story about, he's in his 50s when this story starts.
Yes.
So there is an angle on this that's just like, don't give up. Persistence is key. Even this 52-year-old down in his luck guy created McDonald's. There is a take on this story that's that, which would have been more of a crowd pleaser. This is the more sort of like layered, thoughtful take on it, I think.
Yeah, these are people in the final act of their business careers, like I am. I'm 53 now. Ray Kroc was 52. Mac and Dick McDonald were 52 and 45.
Yeah.
This was a $25 million budget film. Feels like more, probably because of Michael Keaton in the role of Ray Kroc. $24 million box office, so the thing broke even. Has a really strong 81% approval rating on Rotten Tomatoes. I thought it would be higher. I thought this would be something that the critics would like a lot more than that. Just overall on a film, you thought this was excellent, great? Where would you put it in your, you know, scoring system?
I think this is really good. I think it's definitely above average for a biopic, and I think it takes some interesting risks. It takes some interesting chances in exploring Ray Kroc story with a little bit more thoughtfulness, I think there's a more obvious, easy version of this movie out there that you could make that this one kind of doesn't go for. And I sort of admire that about it.
Did you know of this film before I suggested it? Had you seen it?
Yeah, I didn't see this in theaters, but I think I saw it. I think there was a little bit of Oscar buzz this year around Keaton. And so when it first hit VOD or home video, I probably would have checked it out to see that Keaton performance. Yeah.
How I discovered this is, people know my favorite musician is Mark Knopfler from the band Dire Straits. When Dire Straits broke up in the late 90s and stopped touring, he went on to do solo work. One of his solo albums, Shangri-La, which is exceptional, from 2004, has an amazing song on it. And the song is called Boom Like That.
Croc style.
And like this song, it was just, I rocked out to this song driving. I always loved it. And I listened to the words, and I, you know, as you frequently do, you listen to the lyrics and you start to put together, what is this song about? I just like the catchy beat, right? And the guitar riffs. And then I found out Mark Knopfler had read Grinding It Out, the autobiography of Ray Kroc. I guess Mark Knopfler had read it, then wrote this song. The person who wrote the screenplay had also, like me, been a fan of Mark Knopfler, and that is the origin story of the movie, is my understanding, is that he heard the song, then read the Ray Kroc book, Grinding It Out, which the movie The Founder is based on, and the song by Mark Knopfler is called Boom Like That. I just want to give you the lyric here, Lon, and get your reaction to it. Sometimes you got to be an SOB. You want to make a dream reality. Competition? Send them south. They're going to drown. Put a hose in their mouth. Do not pass go. Go straight to hell. I smell that meat hook smell. Oh, my name's Ray Kroc. That's Kroc with a K. Like crocodile, but not spelt that way. Oh, it's dog eat dog, rat eat rat. Kroc style. Boom like that.
Oh, it's dog eat dog, rat eat rat.
Okay, you've seen Sun and I demo a ton of AI tools, and we've learned that these tools are going to help you do so much more with less. That means more revenue and less overhead. But here's the hard part for a lot of companies. How do you actually integrate your AI into your daily workflow? Well, you got to check out CuraTech. CuraTech specializes in strategic consulting and product engineering for AI tools. CuraTech starts with strategic consulting, and they bring those ideas to life with their expert engineering teams. They offer a few key services: AI strategy roadmapping. These are collaborative sessions to find out where AI can give you and your company a competitive edge. AI-powered SaaS features, where they're going to strategize, design, and even write the code for your AI SaaS product, and they'll help you automate repetitive tasks. So here is your call to action. CuraTech is offering their $10,000 AI strategic roadmapping service for 50% off. This includes up to 3 90-minute sessions to find opportunities for AI in your business, a comprehensive breakdown of these opportunities, and a technical roadmap to make the solutions a reality. So go check out curatech.com/twist and get $5,000 off. That's CuroTech.com/twist. CuroTech.com/twist.
His take seems to be the more negative one, that you know, this was almost theft. This was corporate theft. And I think, you know, again, that's there's a movie that's that version of it, where it's just, here's this monster. He stole this company away from these two good guys who just wanted to make people delicious cheeseburgers. And I think that they don't go for that either. They definitely, it's a measured, like, because I think the movie's very aware of McDonald's would not ever have been McDonald's if it was up to Dick and Mac. Like, they were never, they might have franchised it around. There might have been 10 or 12 locations around the Midwest or whatever. Those guys were never going to turn it into this juggernaut that has changed the world, created the fast food industry, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a balance there. It's something to think about.
Just so people know, we took the screenplay, we took the autobiography and put it into Notebook LM, the new Google Notebook LM, which we had the creator of on the pod recently. We tried to see if, you know, they're going to drown, put a hose in their mouth, which is in the film and is in the song, is in the biography or autobiographies. We couldn't find them. So if you find the origin of that quote, I think Mark Knopfler made it up. But I love that evocative line.
Yeah. It's interesting because if you look at, if you Google it, which I did, a lot of those fake SEO bait, like brainy quote sites bring it up and say they misattribute it or attribute it to Ray Kroc, but I could not find an actual citation. So I think all of those are quoting him from this movie, which are quoting probably that Mark Knopfler song.
Yeah, absolutely. Don't trust the internet. All right, let's get into the plot here.
Unless, I mean, it is possible he read a different, he maybe read the autobiography of Ray Kroc and then he read a different book about Ray Kroc that does have that quote in it. Because it does seem like if you were writing your own autobiography, you probably wouldn't self-attribute that quote.
Yeah, I mean, a song does not need to be, it's an interpretation of the spirit of the person here.
No, right.
And yeah, I mean, it wouldn't need to be a
Ray
quote.
He didn't say all those other things. He's putting words in his mouth.
Yes.
Throughout. And that's, we should note, Mark Knopfler does that all the time. Like a lot of his songs are,
yes.
It's not him speaking, it's a character speaking.
Most like, famously.
Yeah, I was going to say that the Money for Nothing, where he's using slurs or whatever. It's not the Mark Knopfler, the singer. He's playing a guy who's narrating that song.
Look at those yo-yos. That's the way you do it. Make that money on the MTV. Yeah,
exactly.
So let's get into the story here, because the story of McDonald's has so many business lessons and the movie's super compelling. So we'll use the movie as the bones of the architecture as we go through the story.
Yeah. So we open in 54 in St. Louis. At this point, Ray Kroc, he's in his 50s. He is a traveling milkshake mixer salesman. He's got this 5-spindle milkshake mixer that I guess if you had a very busy 50s diner and you needed to make a bunch of milkshakes at a time and customers didn't want to wait for you to individually make the milkshakes, this would be a helpful device. But he's bombing out. We see him going to, from diner, a lot of those 50s drive-in diners, and he's trying to sell them on this milkshake. Nobody's biting. While he's there, we kind of note him. He's clocking the problems with this entire restaurant concept, that you end up waiting a ton of time. They're not efficient. They don't get you your food quickly. When it does arrive, a lot of the time the orders are wrong. And then it's also not an environment where you want to sit and spend time and eat. There's hoodlums and teenagers. It's noisy. It's chaotic. There's trash everywhere. It's not a place he feels welcome and invited, even as he's there trying to sell them this milkshake mixer. Then, crucially, he gets an order for 6 of these devices, which, if you've been paying attention up until now, he's had trouble selling even one. So he's thinking about what kind of restaurant could possibly need to make, you know, 6 times 5, 30 milkshakes simultaneously. He finds out it's this burger place called McDonald's in San Bernardino, California. You could still go visit that very first San Bernardino. It's not still a McDonald's. Now it's like a museum dedicated to the first McDonald's, but it's still standing.
It's a really good observation you had of him clocking the joint, and they do this visually in the film with you see him looking at the garbage, seeing somebody smoking, the loud music, he gets his food. He realizes like he's selling into a suboptimal business in and of itself, and they don't have any conception of, well, if we made food faster, then people would come more often. And it really is an interesting insight that not only he had, but that the McDonald brothers had the same one at the same time. And so in entrepreneurship, often many people come to the same epiphany, the same opportunity at the same time. When before Facebook came out, there were Friendster and MySpace and a number of other social networks, for example. But sometimes it takes somebody like Zuckerberg to come in and see it be a mess, like MySpace was a mess. And I thought of MySpace as the analogy here to these, you know, burger joints. Like he came in there and made it fast and organized and clean and friendly and efficient, right? And so,
yeah, I mean, the movie really does give you, and I don't know how accurate all, like maybe there were other fast food operations at the same time doing this, but according to the film, the McDonald brothers had a tremendous amount of innovations all in one that Ray Kroc is seeing all together. It was instead of driving your car up, you park and you walk up, which cuts down on the, you know, sick chaos of people sitting in their cars and the people on roller skates having to go between, navigate through all these cars. It cleans it up. It allows them to control the environment more. They use this incredibly efficient factory style assembly line to make the burgers, which we see Richard McDonald has worked out in extreme explicit detail where everybody is and what their movements are, where they have to go to get their supplies. And so maximizing efficiency to get the burgers done in 30 seconds or less, which allows them to to handle so many more customers. And even there's a great moment when Ray Kroc first arrives at this McDonald's. He gets it. It's a long line and he gets to the back and the lady in front of him, she says, don't worry about it. It goes really quickly. And it's right here. And
don't worry. It moves fast.
Really?
The opposite of the exact opposite 180 of the experience we just saw him have at the other drive-in restaurant where it takes forever. They became known, the brand became associated with taking forever, getting your order wrong. Whereas this lady is so confident that they're going to be fast. She's like, don't worry about it. We're going
to
get right
up. And when he gets to the window, he gets his change. It's 35 cents. He gets 15 cents change, I remember. Yeah. And the guy turns around, grabs a burger from the rack, grabs a milkshake because right. they have a little menu, and they hand it to him. And he thinks it's a mistake. Michael Keaton's like, I just ordered. That's a mistake. And that shows you how profoundly different this experience was. This is very important for founders to understand. You can make something so profoundly different that it viscerally changes a person's experience, right? And you have that experience. I think Uber is a really good analogy for that. When you first use an Uber or you first use DoorDash, it was so dramatically different than calling on the phone and getting an order. Before that, using movie phone to buy tickets or Amazon Prime. And so my mind was like, always there's room to make something faster and cheaper. And this did essentially both.
Yeah. And I mean, there are other innovations too, the all paper packaging. So before you had to worry about plates and forks and where are people going to sit to eat their meal and breaking, the dishes are shattering constantly. It costs a lot of money. They're constantly replacing dishware. So that was another McDonald's innovation was, you know, it's all paper. You just throw your trash away when you're done. And you know, he's sitting there sort of marveling at all of these lessons that they've learned. He introduces himself. He gets a little tour behind the scenes. And then he tells the McDonald brothers he wants to take them out to dinner, hear all about their story. He says, this is the most amazing restaurant I've ever seen. And I've seen it all. I've been in the food service industry for years. So then, you know, we get to this whole scene where we're sort of, the movie lets Mac and Dick kind of relate to us the McDonald's story up until 1954.
Yeah.
They had a couple different companies, couple different concepts before they made a lot of the same observations that Ray Kroc had made about how inefficient these drive-in diners were. And they kind of came to their own conclusions and then they kind of walk them through how they fixed it.
Yeah. And this is really the product market fit moment of the film. And in our industry, product market fit is you conceive of a product and then you try to find if a market responds to that product. And here, they talked about how they tried to get people to embrace this, but it was really hard because people were upset that they couldn't get service in their car. But then once people got it and they enjoyed how amazingly consistent it was and how good it tastes and the price and the speed, all of that added up to that they had market pull. And they demonstrate market pull in the film when they have a big opening. And, you know, the big opening's amazing. They put big lights out there because they had previously worked in the movie business. So they put those floodlights out there. They put jugglers and clowns, whatever, to get people excited. Everybody showed up. Everybody loved it. A bunch of flies showed up and it kind of canceled the party. So the next day, they thought they had to go back to the drawing board. But then slowly, people started showing up because they had such a great experience and word of mouth happens. And Lon, this is the key to the success of McDonald's, but it's also the key to being a great entrepreneur. You know you've done it when you have market pull. What is market pull? That's when you get virality, where people are telling their friends about the product. This can be experienced with something called Net Promoter Score, when people rate you a 9 or a 10, as opposed to a 1 through 8. But it's so good that people promote your service for you. McDonald's was so good. It was so revolutionary. This humble burger, fries, and shake, very simple for the pickup window. It was so dramatically different that people told their friends about it. When people tell their friends about it, you cut out one of the major expenses in business. Lon, what is that major expense?
The acquisition, the cost of acquisition.
Customer acquisition, marketing. Exactly. All right. Listen, we all know starting a business used to be a real pain in the neck. You needed to get a lawyer. There were tons of hidden fees. It was a mess. Now, with Northwest Registered Agent, it only takes 10 clicks and 10 minutes, Northwest provides everything you need to start and maintain your business. Every LLC, corporation, or nonprofit Northwest Forms comes equipped with registered agent service, a business address, a website, and hosting, email, a phone number, and all of this is covered by Northwest's privacy by default settings. Again, your full business identity is going to be live in 10 minutes and in 10 clicks. So here's a very simple call to action for $39 plus state fees. They're going to form your LLC, your corporation, or your nonprofit, and you'll be able to launch your business in just minutes. Visit northwestregisteredagent.com/twist today. That is northwestregisteredagent.com/TWIST today. And so when Uber came out, they didn't need to market. When Teslas came out, they didn't need to market. Why? Their net promoter scores were so high that when I got my first Tesla, and you were there when I had it, people asked for a ride in it. People asked questions about it. It was so transcendent. So this is this super important. And I'll just end on this part. In terms of product market fit, I don't know if you noticed this as well, Lon. They made a point of demonstrating the ketchup and mustard dispenser. Now, the reason I believe they did this was because they wanted to show that it wasn't that they had actually made physical innovations. So they had made some sort of a funnel with a handle and a grip. And when you squeezed it, it portioned out four dots of ketchup or four dots of mustard perfectly. And what that allowed them to do.
This is still used in the fast food industry today. You'll see behind the scenes at like Taco Bell where they got a little gun because it puts the exact right amount of sour cream on the taco or guacamole on the burrito or whatever. So yes, it's exactly like that.
And so they had, and he asked them, where did you get that piece of equipment? And they said, oh, we made it. We fabricated it. And so I just want to end on this piece. You may think a business is too simple, like getting a cab, right? Or, you know, making a burger. But if you make it 20% better across 10 different vectors, now you might have something that's 200% better than what you had previously. So you don't have to have one thing that makes it better. What McDonald's showed was they had a series of maybe 30 innovations, hard fought. Some of them were simple, some of them were complex, but they had the audacity to not stop innovating and creating efficiency. I'll end there.
Nick Offerman plays Richard, who's sort of the brains behind the operation. And I think he's presented as being completely relentless. Like it was never good enough. Even when he figured out a problem, he was just immediately on to the next problem. He was just constantly looking at this entire operation holistically and thinking about how can I make it? Like the first scene we see of them, he's talking to his brother about, I think if we increase the temperature on the fries by 25 degrees and put them in there for a slightly less amount of time, they'd come out a little crispier. And everybody else is like, oh, you're crazy. They're already delicious. But that's just the way his brain works. He was constantly like, how do we shave an extra 1% off the time it takes to make this? Or how do we make it taste 1% better? And if you come in with that attitude every single day, eventually you get McDonald's, you know?
Yeah. And to not make it all about the McDonald brothers, Ray Kroc, during the same thing, was listening in his hotel as he's driving from town to town, trying to sell his five spindle milkshake maker. He's listening to self-help records.
Yeah.
And the self-help author, and he's got like a portable record player with him that he's ostensibly sets up every night in his hotel room to listen to the same records over and over again. And it's talking about resiliency and what business is about. And so when I meet young founders and I introduce them to a business book to be inspiring, or like we're doing right here, or when I'm doing This Week in Startups, I was thinking how important it is to tell stories and to look for inspiration. And Ray Kroc was a relentless entrepreneur who was relentlessly trying to make himself better and find a big win. He just needed one win because the two or three things he had tried to do previously didn't work. And he's constantly getting mocked for those things. But here he is, the person who created McDonald's, the modern day McDonald's, not the original drive-in. It's important for you to remember the self-help that he was listening to self-help would be the equivalent of today listening to podcasts.
Well, I mean that's still like a trope in this kind of movie, in the sort of the go-getter, plucky upstart. A lot of the time they're listening to motivational stuff in the car at the beginning of the movie. And I think they tweak it in a really interesting way here, where we open with him listening to this motivational record about resiliency. And then at the end, we see him and he's preparing to give a speech of his own and he's ripping it off. He's plagiarizing the record he listened to in the opening scene as his own speech talking about the importance of resiliency. So I think it's shading it in a way. It's like, well, is it just resiliency? Because the McDonald brothers were resilient as well. Is it just resiliency? Or is it the willingness to do whatever it takes?
Oh, yes. We're going to get
to
there.
To win.
Yes.
I think there is an element of that, too, that resiliency is the nice way of putting it. Mm-hmm. The not as nice way of putting it is, And you won't stop. You won't let anything stop you. Not ideology, yes. morality, nothing.
Ethics,
you're going to win.
Winning is all that matters. Win at all cost.
Right. And I think
It's a two-sided coin. You remember the scene from, I think it was American Beauty. I will sell this house today.
Right.
I will sell this house today.
I mean, this is a trope. A lot of these movies about ambitious people or people are down on their luck, but they're go-getters. They're driven. They're ambitious. They're going to win. They need this. They're desperate. A lot of that, you know, those are the people who are listening to sometimes podcasts, sometimes How to Win Friends and Influence People, you know, those kinds of stuff.
All right.
Tony Robbins comes up in a lot of movies.
So at this point, Croc has lost his mind, right? He's totally blown away. And one of the brothers comes out and says, oh, how are you enjoying your hamburger? So some people sitting on a bench. Croc says, this is the best one I've ever had in my life. He says, oh, well, we aim to please. And how would you like a tour?
Right. And so then, he takes him to dinner. They give him the whole kind of story. And immediately he's like, let's get into business. There need to be McDonald's all over the place. What are you guys doing with one burger stand? And they're hesitant at first because apparently they've had bad experiences. Other people have come to them with similar deals. It didn't go well. They weren't able to keep quality consistent. They are so focused on their San Bernardino location. They wanted other people to come in and start these other franchises, but then those other franchises aren't as good and don't keep up the standard. It's their name. It's their business. Makes them feel bad. So they've had this bad experience. And as Mac tells Ray, he'd prefer to have one great restaurant than 50 mediocre ones. It's not just about the money for them. It's about the brand. It's about the pride. It's about making great burgers for people. They don't want to make a subpar product. So they say no, but you know, that obviously does not, you know, everything we've talked about with Ray already, that doesn't sit well. So he's immediately scheming. How am I going to get these guys to say yes? And he, while driving around doing his sales trips, he comes up with the sort of pitch in a very, it's a kind of Mad Men inspired sequence where he gives them like a Draper kind of pitch where it's like, don't do this for me. Don't do it for yourselves. Do it for your country. America needs McDonald's. Yes. He's talking about, you know, he was driving around and he sees every community there's a cross because that's where people gather for the church. And there's a flag because that's where people gather for the government or for the court. And then he's like, to him, the golden arches of McDonald's, which was not his invention, which was Richard McDonald's idea. But he thinks the golden arches need to be just as prominent and it's just as important and central to American life. And it's this very patriotic, do it for your country kind of pitch.
And this is where complementary skill sets of founders, you know, comes into play. The people who start a company are not the ones who always get it to the promised land. And, you know, you'll sometimes have complementary people on the team. You know, Steve Jobs and his partner Wozniak is a perfect example. Woz was building the circuit boards, was the nerd, was the technical person. But Steve was the visionary, clearly. And, you know, people sometimes remember Wozniak and sometimes they remember the third co-founder who got bought out of Apple. But most of the time, they just say Steve Jobs. I say Apple, you say Steve Jobs.
Right.
And, you had Dick McDonald, who was just insane at operations, you know, doing all those little innovations. And Mac was like a, you know, kind of like a storytelling CEO type, jovial, you know, shaking hands, kissing babies type guy.
I think if you think of it in restaurant terms, like Dick was running the kitchen and Mac was front of house, you know, greeting customers, managing the staff, that kind of stuff.
But neither of them were the scaling CEO. And when we are talking about technology startups here in, Silicon Valley, we talk about like a 0-1 founder, a product visionary, somebody who can get a product into the world. But then you need people who know how to scale a business. If you want it to become a venture scale or a truly significant business in the world, McDonald's and the McDonald's brothers didn't want to do that. They wanted to have one really great business. But that was not the ambition of the scalable, you know, CEO in Ray Kroc. He saw a vision of how to make this grow across the country. And that really becomes the central tension, I guess, of the second act, you would say. Is the friction between the brothers and Ray Kroc's ambition. Listen, public markets can be volatile. Don't I know it? And if you're looking for a unique asset class to diversify with, let me tell you about Blue Chip Art. Blue Chip Art has historically been uncorrelated with the stock market. And Bloomberg reported that as equities dipped in 2022, Blue Chip Art had its best year on record. Last year, the big three auction houses posted record high revenues of a combined $17.7 billion. But here's the problem. Blue Chip Art has always been an exclusive asset class until Masterworks. With Masterworks, anyone can invest in fine art without needing millions of dollars. This is because Masterworks securitizes blue chip pieces, then sells the shares to investors. And Masterworks provides liquidity. To date, Masterworks has sold over $45 million worth of art. And net proceeds have been paid out to everyday investors, not billionaires. Masterworks has more than 840,000 users and north of $800 million in assets under management, AUM. And Twist listeners get special access to skip the waitlist. Just go to masterworks.com/twist. That's masterworks.com/twist. To skip the waitlist. Past performance doesn't guarantee future results. See important disclosures at masterworks.com/CD.
It becomes, as we've seen in so many of these kind of business movies, especially based on true stories, this was the sort of the theme of BlackBerry as well. When you've got multiple large personalities with very clear visions for what they want to do and what the company should be, you're setting up these kinds of power struggles become almost inevitable. So, yeah, Ray gets the brothers to agree to make him sort of director of franchise operations or something similar. So he's going to go around the country starting new McDonald's franchises. The brothers will take a small cut. He'll take a somewhat larger, but still fairly small cut. And he'll manage all of these other McDonald's restaurants and keep their quality up so that it befits the brand. So he opens the first McDonald's in Des Plaines, Illinois. I believe it's still there as well. This is where we get into him, a lot of him like hustling. So first working the people at the country club, working his connections there, and then finding new ways to find new people to kind of recruit. It's almost a little bit of like an MLM scheme for him at this point. Like the more franchisees he signs up, the more McDonald's he opens, the more 2% takes he's getting of everybody's business. So it's kind of like he's the upstream and they're the downstream a little bit.
And that is the criticism of the franchise business model. And it's also the great part about it is, you know, the franchisees have to do all the work, but they may get this incredible formula. Now, this is something that's hotly debated. If you dive into Subway, and we should do a deep dive into Subway, because I'm sure they'll make a movie about Subway at some point. Those franchisees are really ground down, and grinding it out is the name of Kroc's book. So there is something to this. You have to be a grinder. And in terms of this film, you know, it really shows that food service and restaurants is a grinded out business. It is not a business for rich people who are, you know, retiring and don't want to work. And there's this very important moment as he's trying to find people to open up these franchises. He starts at the country club with people who have the money and it's no big deal. They sign it and then they go back to playing golf and drinking, you know, martinis. But the problem is those people have no standards. They don't care about the restaurant. They just want to flip their money. And that infuriates Kroc. And of course, that infuriates the McDonald's brothers who care about quality above all else. And so there's this great pivot where he goes from country clubs to synagogues, veterans associations. Yeah. Who else does he hit up? Oh, the first person. Tell everybody about the first person that he recruits as a franchisee when he decides rich people are not going to get this done. I need blue-collar, hard-working, salt-of-the-earth people.
The Jewish Bible salesman, this guy, is that what we're talking about? Yeah, so there's a lot, I guess you see it in older movies where people are just in the same office and they overhear somebody's conversation. They're like, that's the guy I need to be in business. But I feel like this doesn't happen in today's world as much.
There are random collisions. This would fall into the category of collisions or
so
sliding doors.
Meeting. He goes to his own office and there's this very pushy Bible salesman trying to sell to his own secretary who's not interested. And this guy is just relentless, not giving up. And then he stops him in the hallway and he's like, hey, you know, who are you? Tell me about yourself. The guy, his name's Greenbaum or something
Greenblatt.
Obviously Jewish. So it's like, you're a Jewish guy selling Bibles. The guy's like, look, I gotta make my nut. I gotta earn a living. And that's how he's like, that's the kind of light bulb moment for Ray.
Yes.
It's like, I need people who they need this. This is going to become their life. They're going to be obsessed with this the way I'm obsessed with this. Not these country club guys who don't really care. They've already made their money. I need hungry people.
You know, in our industry, we want people to have skin in the game. And this is why in our industry, you know, people selling or founders selling their secondary shares and not having a mortgage payment or kids in private school or, you know, 12 months of runway, 6 months of runway, 18 months of runway. The venture capital community and the architecture of the entire system is a bit of a pressure cooker. It's very rare that somebody gets 5 years of funding and some huge salary that competes with the salary they had at Apple or something. And that pressure makes the diamond. Skin in the game is what we're looking for with founders and with venture capitalists. They have to put a certain percentage of their money into their venture funds.
And the movie also, it sort of does this with Ray and his wife, who's played by Laura Dern, Ethel Cohn, where even she, they don't see eye to eye because she's at the point where they're in their 50s. She's like, we own our home. You've had your years of being a salesman on the road. Like, isn't it time for you to slow down and start thinking about retiring or spending more time with me, going to dinners, you know, enjoying your life
more. Maybe go to Spain. She wants to go to Spain.
She wants to go to Spain. Yeah. And he can't function that way. That's just not who he is. And we sense that that's never going to be who he is. It doesn't matter how much money he makes, how comfortable he gets. He's never going to want to just rest on his laurels and stop building. He's just that kind of a person. He wants to win. He's competitive and that's the only sort of life that he can envision for himself. And so, you know, later over the course of the film, he meets a franchisee named Raleigh Smith and his wife, Joan, who's much more of his kind of mindset. She's a go-getter. She's hungry. She's ambitious. She loves money and wants to make more money. And so, you know, you can see that's the attraction of him to her is that, you know, again, it is about skin in the game, but it's also just about having that kind of motor, just having that personal ambition versus, you know, it's just a different kind of person who's not as caught up in the rat race, you know?
I was going to bring this up. Spouses are so critical in the formation of startups. Now, you'd think, like, well, they don't go to the startup every day. But if you think about it like an Olympic athlete, or if you think of it like a Navy SEAL or somebody who's doing some extreme pursuit, well, their spouse might have to sacrifice. Oh, they're on a tour of duty, you know, in Afghanistan, or they're going to the Olympics and they've got to do 3 workouts a day and they're going to be, you know, doing some competitions all over the world. The spouses bear the brunt of that often in startup land. They have to take care of the family if there's a family. They have to manage the domestic stuff. And this becomes a bit of tension often because one person is pursuing their life dream and they're getting all this glory. And the other person is doing all the chores and having to cheer them on. And then the person who's cheering them on will become resentful. And then the person who is going out and working on this, they might have their spouse then become critical of what they're doing. And then that is the death of the marriage. It's the death of the partnership. It just becomes irreconcilable often. And that's why often when I talk to people who have families and kids, and they're starting a company and they want my advice, I say, well, have you talked about this with your partner slash spouse, whatever your, you know, common term is, make sure you have that aligned. Because some people are work to live and some people live to work. And this is like the tension you see when I tweet on Twitter or X on Twitter, whatever I'm doing on Twitter, posting on X, you know, and I say like hard work pays off. And then people are like, ah, but what if it doesn't? It's like, well, that's kind of implied, but okay. And it's just fundamentally, some people, when the whistle blows at 5 o'clock, that's when their life begins. Other people, when the whistle blows in the morning, they get to work, that's when their life begins.
Yeah.
So different strokes for different folks.
Yeah. And I think that is part of the sort of, it's both the McDonald brothers versus Ray Kroc. It's Ray versus his wife, Ethel. We see that kind of play out several times over the course of the movie. Those kind of just very different ways of measuring success and what does it mean to be a success and what does it mean to like have a successful company or marriage or, you know, whatever else. So I think that's really interesting. So at this point in the movie, Ray has kind of, he started having the same kind of success and market pull that the McDonald brothers had. Now Ray is starting to experience where rather than going out and recruiting, people are coming to him. McDonald's is becoming a breakout sensation. He takes this trip to Minneapolis where they're opening a new franchise and he gets this kind of hero's welcome and he realizes like, oh, this is really, I'm on to something. This is really taking off. And that's the point where the tensions really start to build between him and the McDonald's brothers because he starts to feel more ownership. Like, I've built this into this huge thing. Sure, you guys had the idea of how to make the burgers, but now we're all contributing. It doesn't just feel like it's your company that I'm helping with. It's also my company now. I think part of what they're implying is that this was always kind of who Ray Kroc was, and he's just becoming unleashed. The more powerful he gets, the more rich he gets, the more status he gets, the more he's sort of free to become that person, and he doesn't have to be the salesman anymore who's constantly pitching and glad-handing everybody. So as he kind of comes into his own more, we get a lot of back and forth where he wants to make changes and the McDonald brothers are not into it. Like, the main one being that the contract he's getting, I think it's 1.9% of the revenue from these franchise restaurants. He was so eager to sign the deal, he didn't really worry about the math at the time.
Yes.
Now that it's really taking off and succeeding, he's recognizing that that's not that much money. I've got all this overhead that I'm managing, and I'm only getting 2% of all of these actual locations. I'm not getting rich the way I should be getting rich.
And this is a path that founders go along. You have complete doubt and uncertainty and fear, and then you start winning, and then your confidence builds, and then that confidence can become arrogance. It can become narcissism. It can become, you know, momentum. It can go either way, and often it goes multiple ways. And so it's important for founders to not feel so low in the beginning when you're figuring out product market fit and you're figuring out the business, because that is the part of the process. Is the suffering, is the, you know, not making enough money, is being underappreciated. And then what happens is you hit it. And when you hit it, then all of a sudden, everybody wants to be your friend. Everybody's giving you applause, thanking you, hugging you. You're the greatest person ever. And this is where, you know, having a strong foundation as an individual, a strong sense of morality, a strong sense of ethics, a strong sense of who you are as a person. And this is where your parenting and everything comes into this. And what will happen is people who are not grounded, man, you can see them go off the rails, all different kind of directions. And tragically, people who don't get product market fit, you know, they can get depression and worse. And so I thought that the movie did such a good job of capturing his journey from just being considered a loser by everybody, knowing he was actually a winner, knowing he saw these opportunities that other people couldn't see. He knew, Lon, that he had it. He knew he had it, but the world doubted him. And then he starts turning a corner. And every week, every month, every franchise that joins, he realizes he's awesome at this. And everybody who doubted him is wrong. He gets the divorce from his wife. He gets the new wife who is, you know, aesthetically, you know, played as younger and more beautiful. And more importantly, who wants to be his partner in crime and his right. partner who pumps him up and says, you can do it and you're awesome. And wants to be involved and celebrating the victories, not...
Who needs real ice cream? We need profits.
Yeah. Nick, producer Nick coming in with a really great drop. Maybe you could take us to that moment where the new wife getting involved in the business and rolling up her sleeves and is thinking like Kroc, and how that moment plays into his relationship where Kroc finally confronts the McDonald brothers.
So this is one of those movie, the law of efficiency of characters, what Roger Ebert would call it. Like, you can't just constantly introduce new characters, so you got to consolidate when you can. So this did not all come from the real Joan Smith. She was a McDonald's franchisee. They did eventually get married. But the movie, for convenience sake, also gives her the powdered milkshake idea. And apparently this was not, that's apocryphal. But anyway, yeah, in the movie, she comes to him with this discovery that one of the major expenses of running a McDonald's franchise at that point was these big walk-in freezers where you'd store the ice cream. And that's what, it's a thing that it annoys Ray at his franchise. It annoys the other franchise owners. It's soaking up a lot of what should be their profits. So right. Linda Cardellini, who plays Joan Smith, she discovers in one of those trade industry magazines, powdered milkshakes, which you could sort of simulate the milkshake experience, but it doesn't require a freezer. It's not real ice cream. You just mix the powder into water. And it did one of those food science discoveries in the 50s and 60s they were so into.
It's kind of a NASA kind of moment, right? They were taking freeze-dried stuff.
Yeah.
You know,
the food chemistry and food labs and all that, all those discoveries in terms of like chemical artificial flavoring and all that was big, big business at this time. And they were constantly coming out with these new kinds of products. And, you know, today stuff like powdered milkshakes and powdered potatoes or whatever, where there's a lot of we already stereotype that as like, oh, that's institutional food. That's cafeteria food. That's prison food. But in the 50s and 60s, they were obsessed with technology. They thought that stuff was amazing. This is the future. Everybody's going to eat powdered milkshakes one day.
Yeah.
So Ray and Joan, very excited about this idea. But Richard McDonald is like, milkshakes have ice cream in them. It's a part of the deal. No. And just refuses to negotiate or discuss or talks about it. So that kind of becomes the last straw.
And this is a key because we haven't talked about deal making and negotiation. But in order to get the deal for McDonald's, he had to agree that the McDonald's brothers would approve every change to what happens in that restaurant. So if he wanted to change the ice cream and milkshakes to a powdered one, he needed to get explicit written approval from the McDonald's brothers, which they would never give. And they were slow and they were resistant to change.
Right. So he's trying to sort of figure out this power struggle. And it's another one of those kismet. He's just having this conversation and then somebody's like, hey, I have the answer. But he meets Harry Sonnenborn, played by the office vet BJ Novak, who would later go on to become McDonald's first CEO. He's just at the bank as a fellow customer, overhears this problem, and meets with Kroc and figures out the solution. This very elegant, somewhat devious solution, which is rather than focusing on the franchise itself and taking a little piece of the profits of the franchise, McDonald's should be buying the plots of land that the restaurants go on, and then they lease those plots of land to the franchise owners, which gives the McDonald's company all the control over the location rather than the franchise owner, and they're just taking a little chunk of change every month of the profit.
So let me reflect this back so the audience doesn't miss it. McDonald's had franchisees. The McDonald's brothers own the McDonald's experience, and Ray is in the middle. He can't make enough money off of the 1.9% he negotiated.
Is there a problem?
A big one. You don't seem to realize what business you're in.
And so this clever person says, well, you know, you're really in the real estate business. Why is he in the real estate business? It turns out when McDonald's opens a restaurant, the entire world goes next to them. So they're so successful that they, in fact, are distribution. And Starbucks has a similar phenomenon. If you put a Starbucks, they research where they're going to put them really well. When you place a Starbucks, the block on either side of that Starbucks now goes up massively in value. Why? Foot traffic, obviously. So they were leasing the land under the McDonald's, building these iconic buildings with the arches, as you can see in Lon's background there, key part of the story. But they were leasing it from landowners. Who benefits from that? The landowners. Now, if you wanted to get around the McDonald's brothers deal, well, if you own the land, if Ray Kroc had a separate company that owned the land and he leased it to the new franchisee, so the franchisee signs the franchisee documents, finds a construction person, builds it, and then opens their restaurant, does it matter if they get the land from Ray Kroc or they get it from some random landowner? Well, Ray Kroc realizes that's the business. I'm assuming they didn't mention this in the story. We could ask our Google Notebook LM, which has a bunch of McDonald's information in it, if they would also buy the plots of land around them. It would seem like you should buy as many plots around a McDonald's as possible before you install it. But that was the key there, because now they're the landlord in a 10 or 20 year lease. If it's successful, then what's the price going to be? They own the land outright, and then they get to charge the franchisee whatever they want. And the thing that they don't mention, Lon, they know the franchisee's economics. So they can match the rent for that land, the lease, to what they think is the maximum breaking point that doesn't make the franchisee go find another location.
Right.
Which, well, I'm sure is what they did.
It's an exclusive deal. You can't open a McDonald's unless you're leasing the land from the McDonald's corporation. So they don't have a choice. In one other way, it's clever too. From Ray's perspective, it gets him around the McDonald brothers. Like at this point, now he's the center of power. They might be able to say, well, contractually, we control what you do with the burgers. But now he owns the land. The franchisees are working through him. It gives him control over the entire company. And it really gives him free reign at this point to just start ignoring the brothers altogether, which he does in a big display by sending all the franchisees the powdered milkshakes and just doing it anyway, even though the brothers said no.
And the brothers come to him and the brothers say, hey, we're not going to allow it. And when they don't allow it, they say, hey, we have a contract. Ray Kroc just says, well, you know what they say about contracts? They're meant to be broken.
Yeah.
And that's when he goes to the dark side, in my mind. You realize he has the money, he has the power. He's now somehow wrestled control from them. And he feels emboldened to, in any situation in his life, to use the law or to use might and power, money, to just create the world he wants. And this happens in business as well. We just had a situation where Apple is being accused of hiring all these people who built patents for the Apple, for smartwatches and healthcare, like oxygen reading on your watch, and they stole employees and you know, they're apparently being sanctioned now. But, you know, a company like Apple might get reckless as they have money, distribution, and power, and they will roll over people around them. And so this is when Ray, I think, kind of crescends into the, I don't want to say dark side, but just being cutthroat. If you don't agree with me, sue me. If you are not going to support me as a wife, I'm getting divorced, I'll give you everything, but you're not getting a share of McDonald's. And he just went hardcore. This is the hardcore moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. I think the movie is doing something really interesting here. Did Ray go to the dark side? Did the money and the power and the status get to him and get in his head and change him? Or was this always who he was in the back of his mind and he just, it had to wait to come out? Like in the beginning of the movie, he doesn't
I think that's accurate.
He doesn't have the power. His goal the entire time is to get FU money. So that he can unleash his inner capitalist tycoon bastard, I think. I think that's a fair read. But I don't know if that's, I don't think that, I think you could read the movie the other way. That he wasn't always so cutthroat. He learned that that's how you have to be, or that's the way he wanted to be over time.
My take on it is, as you get more confident and you get more power, you will take more risk or you'll be more hardcore. So that would track more with me. He didn't have the power when he was selling milkshakes to roll over anybody. In fact, he was, instead of being on a heater and accumulating power and having momentum as a founder, he was kind of the other way, right? He was on his heels. And when you're on your heels and you're not confident, the idea that you would fire off a lawsuit or you tell somebody, well, F you, sue me if you don't like it, you might not do.
Yeah, we meet him and he's in full salesman mode. I think it's really like the very first scene we see of him. And it's not only just a salesman, it's that kind of Willie Loman, like down on his luck, Shelley Levine, like, I gotta make this sale. It's that desperation.
Yes, desperation.
Like, hey, you look like a smart guy. I don't have to tell you the business, you know, like he's got that. And so I think that's kind of what we're watching too, is this, the how it sort of unleashes him to be able to put that persona aside permanently. I don't have to be the salesman anymore. And that's kind of the scene when he's getting drinks and he gets back from Minneapolis and he's talking to his wife and he's like, they love McDonald's. They were all over me. We got to have a drink. That's what he's really celebrating, is I get to put away being servile forever. I'm nobody's, you know, stool anymore. I get to be in charge now. And it goes from there. Like it only builds from there.
And there's a lot of technical things that occur, you know, around company formation. When he makes this real estate company, he calls it the Franchise Realty Corporation.
Yeah.
But then eventually he's like, you know what? I'm going to call it the McDonald's Corporation. If you don't like it, you can sue me.
It confuses people. It's confusing to people.
Yeah. And he's like, oh, that's the whole point. I'm going to confuse people. I don't care. And this actually happened to go back to Zuckerberg as well. Another incredible entrepreneur with, you know, many would argue, you know, less than top shelf morals or ethics. He screwed all his original business partners, restarted Facebook, sold the assets from an LLC into a C corporation. And that's what the social network was about. Was about this same thing. A person who didn't have power was building, you know, software for the Winklevi, all of a sudden getting some power, getting somebody like Sean Parker in his corner, getting Peter Thiel in his Parker, getting success, and then being like, you know what? Might is right. I have the chips. I have the power. Now I'm going to just do whatever I want. And if you are my previous partner and friend, you can sue me. And so the arc of, and we should do the social network at some point, the arc of Zuckerberg going from, you know, a coder with, you know, a certain ability to copy other people's products and do it better than them, all of a sudden he just becomes a person who doesn't care and will screw anybody, including his best friends. This is a central theme of business. Is it necessary to screw everybody around you to be successful? The answer is it's not. There's many more stories of people being mensches and having a moral compass and being ethical and making sure everybody's taken care of. than Zuckerberg and Ray Kroc.
How much of it do you think came from Kroc feeling like he was being screwed because the percentage was so small? And obviously he was doing so much of a brunt of the expansion work, basically 100% of the expansion work.
Resentment.
And yeah. Exactly. And the McDonald brothers wouldn't budge even a little bit. They wouldn't even give him 2% or 3% or 4% or whatever he was asking for. And another like follow-up to that is, do you think McDonald's would exist in its current iteration if the brothers had just been like, you know what, why don't you take 5%? We know you're doing all this work and we're going to cut you in on 2% of the net profits from everything at the end.
Okay. These are great questions. I'll take them in reverse. If the brothers had played ball with him and gave him more leeway, I think actually it would have grown faster because he wouldn't have been wasting so much time arguing with them. It is possible that he could have destroyed the product, but I think it's unlikely.
At some point, that power struggle was going to come to a head, right? Because no matter how much compromise each side made, their fundamental view of the business was just so different. The McDonald brothers really, they cared about the food quality. They cared about family.
Consistency.
They really bought into that sales pitch of like, no, this is about bringing people together and community and making something great.
How does he eventually get what he wants out of them?
I mean, I think at some point, Ray Kroc was going to screw them and get rid of them.
What he wants from them?
So eventually, they're like, we're going to sue you. You're violating our contract. And he's like, go ahead, sue me. He points out what has become obvious, which is by making this land real estate deal, by forming this huge corporation, he now dwarfs them in terms of power and status. He is the owner of this massive company, McDonald's. They own a burger stand in San Bernardino. So I think once they realize that they've already lost before the argument has even started, because he has this tremendous lead on them, there's basically no choice. They can't sue him. He'd tie them up in court forever. They've got to make a deal. So he makes this deal that is a pretty terrible deal for them. He gives them $2.7 million to split between the two of them. That's worked out mathematically. So each brother walks away with $1 million after taxes. Right. So they get to keep their San Bernardino location. That's theirs. And then they ask him for, they want 1% of all McDonald profits in perpetuity forever. And he says, well, I'd like to give that to you, but the board, we're going to have to do it as a handshake deal.
And I'll fight for you. And then he screws him. My point is, eventually, he just negotiated with them. And so I think that there was a negotiation to be had here. We're playing Monday morning quarterback. I think if the brothers had just extracted a small amount of money each time he wanted a concession, so that, you know, if he wanted to go to 2.5%, okay, well, they want this payout or they want this percentage of the real estate company, et cetera.
But they didn't want to play ball. They didn't want powdered milkshakes, even if it made them $10
billion. But eventually they wanted a payout. So I think the strategic error, I'm talking about strategy here. I agree with you. Their motivation was, you know, this purity. At a point, they said, we don't want to deal with this chaos. We want our money. And I think they should have got better lawyers. And I think they should have been negotiating a slow exit until the company went public. And this is an important lesson for everybody watching. If you are in a situation that, like the McDonald's brothers are in, keep your equity in the business. Make sure you have the equity in the business. Because what that means is, no matter how big it gets, if Lon owns 10% of the business, and let's say I'm Ray Kroc and I own 20%, okay, for every dollar those shares go up and you own $10 worth of shares and I own 20, you go to 11, I go to 22, you're still getting the benefit, but you're not doing any of the work. And this is really why equity and stock ownership, as opposed to licensing deals and royalties, is the gold standard in business, because the share price goes up, everybody wins. Now, of course, people can do funny things like dilute the shares and issue more shares, but in general, those things are frowned upon. The McDonald's brothers did not have great representation, it was clear, and they should have. And they should have never, obviously, walked away without owning equity in the business. And so Ray Kroc was dogged, but man, they could have held on to percentage ownerships. And
yeah,
by
McDonald's
the way,
net the
Facebook
20,
partners oh, did. The Facebook partners did. Eduardo and then the other people, all those early people did wind up keeping shares in the company.
The
Winklevosses, I think he specifically did not want them to own shares.
Eduardo Saverin and those other guys. Yeah.
So again, all of those things become negotiations. So here's the two lessons. Number one, if you're the king or queen and you've won power, you can really negotiate hard. And you're going to wind up on top in all likelihood. But if you're the person who's getting screwed, you really want to fight doggedly to make sure you own equity in it. because that person has proven to you that they're a lunatic. And if that person has proven that they're a lunatic and they'll fight to the end, well, you want to have equity in them. Eduardo Saravin wound up with over 50 million Facebook shares. So he did quite well for himself.
Yeah, he's doing fine.
I just think there's a lesson here about like fiscally compensating people based on their value to the company. Like he was so valuable. And you see, which I think goes back to Lon's point earlier about this being like a really measured take on this. It didn't make him look like a total terrible guy, but it also didn't paint him like a hero. That scene where he's like behind on his mortgage payments and you're like, how is this guy expanding this business so rapidly, doing such an amazing job, and he's missing his mortgage payments? And he's not gambling the money away. He's just like being underpaid. You're like, that's crazy. It was crazy.
There is definitely a personal, emotional dimension to this rivalry that I think for both sides probably kept them from seeing things entirely clearly. Like, Ray Kroc, kind of a hot-headed guy, even by his own admission. He talks about this in the autobiography, I believe, that he was very emotional. He cared about this a lot. He could fly off the handle.
Yeah, he hangs up on them. And the guy's like, what, right. he just hung up on us?
McDonald's brothers immediately get turned off from dealing with him because they're not like that. They're these very gregarious, Midwestern, even-keeled, calm guys. And this guy screaming at them on the phone, they don't like it. So I think they're hesitant to make changes, both because of their ideology, but also because who the hell is this guy to call and bark orders at us? And I think it's the flip side too. Ray, by the end of the movie, has become vindictive, where it's not just about, I want to get the most money, I got to take care of myself. It's like, oh, I'll leave you your San Bernardino restaurant, but then I'm going to open my own McDonald's right across the street and put you out of business.
Yeah, he wants to bury them. Just, it is personal.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Just because now I hate you and we've been combative for so long that now I want to get my sort of revenge and stick the knife in. So I think, it's a business negotiation, but it does inevitably take on this personality clash as well, where they start to hate each other.
The film ends. The McDonald's brothers get their money.
Well, I think there's a fascinating scene at the very end where Dick McDonald and Ray Kroc end up, after the legal proceedings, they end up in the restroom together.
Yeah. And, it's a total total movie trope, by the way. The epilogue in the bathroom.
It's very screenwritery. I'm sure this never happened, but you know.
Take a leak and do the debrief.
You got to get them together for one big final, scene.
Recap of what happened. It's like, what just happened? Why closure. Did we see what we saw?
We as an audience, right. We want closure. We want them to have a final moment coming to terms with each other or whatever. Dick McDonald's basically asking him like, hey, if you were willing to just steal from us and screw us over, why did you want to make a deal with us in the first place? Like we showed you everything. We showed you what we did. You saw the restaurant. You could have just gone home and made your own McDonald's and called it something else. And you didn't have to be in business with us at all. Why not just do that? And he says it's the name McDonald's, that was part of it. Part of the package and the brand and when he showed up that day to get his burger and was blown away, that was part of the experience, was that it was called McDonald's, this very welcoming, friendly, all-American name. He points out his own name, Kroc, very Slavic, immigrant sounding.
So who would ever want to eat at Kroc's is a great line. Well, who would ever want to eat at Kroc's?
And then in the epilogue to the epilogue, so that's like kind of a mini epilogue, but there's another one at the end where they actually show Ray Kroc speaking, and he's talking about how beautiful the McDonald's name is, how iconic it is. And he says, I never like gimmicky names like Burger, Castle or whatever. He's kind of obviously talking about Burger King or, Burger Stop or whatever.
Astro Burgers we have here.
Yeah, and
LA.
He's kind of mocking Burger King and other people who copied it. But it is such a key point of, I think, Ray Kroc's brilliance. Ray Kroc was an observer of humans and opportunities. He was a hustler. He was a grinder, thus the term grinding it out. And he took pride in that. And grinding it out is what startups are about at their best. It is what innovation is about at its best. It is a grind. And it is about resilience and confidence and momentum and just never stopping your innovation. And as an entrepreneur myself, people who have worked for me and you both have worked for me, I might come in after a break and be like, hey, we're doing this new thing. It's Founder University. Hey, we're doing this new thing. It's called This Week in Startups. Hey, we're going to try this. And you have to be constantly trying to come up with something new that clicks. And then you have the thing that clicked and you got to keep tweaking it. So here we are in year 13 of, This Week in Startups. And I'm like, I want to do more of these like business breakdowns with Lon, because they're fun for us to do and the audience loves them. So here we are. Resiliency is the big takeaway for me. Grinding it out, having great lawyers.
And just that understanding of branding from such an early, like today we take that for granted. Everybody sure. is, we're all personal brands. Everybody thinks in that, in those terms. But in 1954,
no.
to be like, you know what? Those golden arches in every town, you'll be on the road and you'll drive and you'll know what that is. And you'll it's going to be consistent everywhere I go. McDonald's is McDonald's. Like, no, he was way ahead of the curve
way ahead
thinking
of time.
About how important that would become for Americans.
Which, by the way, at the start of our careers, we saw this information superhighway as this incredible opportunity because you could transmit information and go anywhere, get any information for free or close to free. And really, the highways, the American highways built in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, were essentially like the platform shift of its time. Route 66, he says early on, Ray Kroc, I have this vision of Route 66, and you can go across the entire country, which was built off the innovation of the factory, which created cars by Henry Ford. And the McDonald's factory, and when they're making that tennis scene, is based on Ford and him making the
assembly line.
So we should sit here for a moment, I think, and reflect on platform changes, right? We're sitting here with AI as a platform change. We witnessed cloud, we witnessed mobile, we witnessed broadband and the internet itself, PC revolution, cloud revolution, all this kind of great stuff. You know, and it just, when there is a new innovation that occurs, like factories and the assembly line, many people can profit from it. Or when there's something like, you know, infrastructure that's built, many people can profit from it. McDonald's wasn't the only people who profited off of Route 66 and, you know, the highway system, hotels.
Yeah, Howard Johnson's would have been the same area. Yeah.
Tons of brands. And then going big is my final lesson here. You know, people do not have a gambler's mindset. And if you look at the McDonald brothers, they had a protectionist mindset, Lon. They wanted to protect what they had because what they had was really special. They weren't willing to risk what they had to have what McDonald's has become. And that was their choice. It's obviously a critical mistake if you want to make a ton of money, but they did make a killing for people who made a hamburger joint, but they only wound up capturing, if you take it as 10 million in today's dollars or, you know, close to 500 million if you had put it into the S&P. Or it would have been $1 billion between the two of them. They only got a fraction of the actual.
Yeah. I mean, McDonald's last year made $6.1 billion in net income. That would have been $61 million if they got their 1%.
Yes. And that would have been every year. And that's for 1 year.
That's 1 year.
That happens every year. So lots of big lessons
there. McDonald's a big company. I think there's one other really interesting.
We were talking about
these sort of sea changes and shifts in not just, you know, individual companies, but the way kind of business is done and approached. And I think this movie is also about another kind of pivotal shift or sea change moment. The McDonald brothers are like when you in elementary school, when they teach you Adam Smith and capitalism, you know, you do those like, you make something at home and then you bring it in and you do a little like mini economy in class. Like I'll sell you, you know, here's what bartering is. And here's, I'll sell you one of these for two of those. And that's how we have an economy. And I think that's where the McDonald brothers stopped. They were like, we want to make the best product for the best value. And we're going to be better than all of our competitors. It'll be faster. The cheeseburger is going to be juicier. And we're going to make everything as perfect as we could. And then that's where they stopped. And I think Ray Kroc represents a modern take on capitalism, which is not just about looking at one product and looking at how much of that product do we sell to how many customers, but all of these elaborate financial systems and products and institutions and ways of investing, ways of thinking about scaling companies and growth.
Scale is the key word, Lon.
It's changed so much. And I think now it's all about, how much are you making this quarter versus last quarter or this quarter versus the same quarter last year?
Yes,
what's
as it should be.
What's your 10-year projection? Yes. How are we going to keep, you know, innovating and how are
and
we going to keep
your total addressable market and what percentage of it are you?
Exactly.
And so the Kroc brothers were never thinking, well, how many milkshakes and hamburgers are eaten every year and how many of those can we capture? They're just thinking, well, there's a person in front of me. How delighted are they with the burger? And so that was the first half of capitalism. And here we are in the second half of capitalism is how much can I capture? Producer Nick, any moments or lessons from this that you take away?
It really was profound to me when he went to Phoenix for the first time, which was the first Golden Arches establishment. And I just thought it was amazing how, you know, that's still a feeling that we all have. If you're on the highway in the United States, if you're on a long road trip and you see the Golden Arches, you're like, oh, I could get some food there. Look, Mickey D's. I just, you know, Jason, you talk about real world virality a lot. And back in the 50s, that basically didn't really exist, right? Like, what was that? And he just saw it. And I said this before, but my other main takeaway was just like, if somebody is doing such a lion's share of the work, you have to get them in on ownership and compensate them properly and keep them around, because that would have been much more lucrative for the McDonald's brothers in the end. And what they did wound up just, and who knows if that's actual really the reality, but yeah, we're just talking about the movie.
Multiple sides to the story, both of their sides and the actual reality are the three that we're left to deal with, right? Yeah, I think those are great thoughts as well. All right, we like to give a little awards here. So Nick, lightning round here. These are the awards for the film producer Nick came up with. What's your first award you want to give?
The number one award, well, you guys have to give them, but you could just choose any character you want. The would hire award for a character you would hire immediately.
So you're telling me there's a chance.
A would hire award. Well, I mean, can we say Ray Kroc?
You could say Ray Kroc, yeah.
I mean, when you got somebody with that much to prove and who's that resilient and dogged and hardworking, that's the person you pick. I mean, after that, it's got to be the guy who explained to him, his like basically consigliere who explained to him how real estate works. Those would be my two.
Harry Sonnenborn,
first CEO of McDonald's.
Yeah, Harry Sonnenborn.
I think we got to take Ray Kroc out of it. So I go with Harry. Who do you go with, Lon?
I mean, I feel like Dick McDonald is a good answer there. Dick McDonald being the sort of the innovator. He's the one that wouldn't, none of it exists without him coming up with the ways to make the burger better. You know, like he's got to be there at the ground floor. You don't have a product.
Got it. So you got the product market fit guy. I got the financial engineering guy. We both would have taken Ray Kroc first, I assume. The would fire award.
You're fired.
For a character, you would fire immediately. Who would you fire immediately? God, I don't want to say the first wife.
She doesn't even work there. She's just,
I know, but she's such a downer. And she's like, doesn't believe in him. And yeah, that she was, man.
They didn't give Laura Dern a lot to work with, by the way, in this movie.
No, poor she Laura played Dern. A sourpuss.
That's such a thankless role, the wife who just wants her husband to stay home. I always think of...
They didn't even really give her like a mad scene either. They didn't let her go.
I always think of... I love Donnie Brasco, but Anne Heche in Donnie Brasco has the most thankless role of... Her job is literally stand in the kitchen and yell at Johnny Depp for not being home enough. And like, there's like four scenes, they keep cutting to it, and it's the same every time. And this is one of those... thankless Anne Heche and Donnie Brasco type roles where why aren't you home more? We should go to space.
Yeah, no, and you're 100% right. Not giving Laura Dern, you know, a really juicy character is just a huge mistake.
Yeah, she's Laura Dern.
She's a queen. Queen. Yeah.
What do you hate? Jump in here? I have an answer for this one. Okay.
Who do you hate?
I would immediately fire
Snap
Joan Smith's like nerd husband. Who just lets Ray Kroc like completely ogle his wife in front of him at the dinner scene. Ray Kroc should have been smacked there. And that guy is just, what a loser. I would fire him in 2 seconds.
He sings a song with her.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an instant toss.
He's just ogling her. Like, and he's like, that's my wife, dude. And he's like, yeah, I don't care.
I mean, maybe just you grab him by the belt.
Actor Patrick Wilson.
I know. Yeah. I know it's Patrick Wilson. Yeah. Yeah. That's what I'm firing. Who are you firing?
Imagine treating Aquaman's brother that way. Let's see, who would I fire? That's the all of the hoodlum teenagers. Get them out of there. None of these hoodlum teenagers can hang around.
Okay, next one, Scarface, Push It to the Limit Award for the best money-making montage.
Oh, there's a few good ones in
here. There are some good ones in here. Push it to the
limit. So in the film, there's the montage when they're on the tennis court.
And I can think of four montages right now in the film that are all.
But there's
like,
a tennis court one, right? That would be considered a montage.
Yes.
I love that because that's the product market fit tennis court montage. That's
operational excellence. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that one.
There's another good one where it's where they're opening up all of the McDonald's and you just get those lower thirds of like each new location as it goes up. And they do a really good job of, I'm assuming it was probably one plot and they would just build out a few different looks to get to make it look like it was different McDonald's locations. I'm sure they didn't build like five whole old school McDonald's, but They shoot it. They're very clever. It definitely does not look like the same location over and over again.
I love the one where he's pitching. He's at like the temple. He's at the synagogue. He's at the mosque. He's at the church.
Yeah.
And he's like, Mazel Tov. Like,
the he's VFA, like doing the different. The VFA.
Make me part of your tribe.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. The absolutely. VFW. Yeah. I love that one.
Right, VFW,
that's pretty great, actually. Yeah. These are good ones.
Because he's even peppering in Yiddish phrases.
Yes, exactly.
Right?
That's what I'm saying.
Right about. He's thankful to be at their mishpucha or whatever.
Yeah. All right. That's good. The next one, the Travis Award for biggest force of nature.
We are going to dominate every city that we go into.
I mean, this one's, you got to, right?
Croc.
There's no other answer.
Yeah. I mean, that's an interesting that you call it the Travis Award, because if you look in the case of Uber, most people felt that he went to Ray Kroc, perhaps, right? And pushed it too hard is the always been the criticism that he was going too hard, too fast, bending, breaking, whatever your interpretation of it, you know, of breaking the rules around who gets to, you know, give people a ride from point A to point B. And then you bring in somebody like, Dara. And so, someone like Dara wants it to grow, wants it to be profitable, but does care about maybe not knocking as many things over. And so that's like the balance between the two. But yeah, it's Ray Kroc.
Gotta be.
100%. Got it.
All right. Any ideas for the next one? Jason, you mentioned Social Network. Ron.
Man.
Are you on board for that? Do you have any other ideas?
Oh, for our next episode?
Yes.
I mean, I think Social Network makes a ton of sense. I think
Moneyball.
Moneyball would be the other one I would say is an interesting movie that still has a lot of like fans and is part of the sort of discourse people talk about a lot. I think that would be...
It's fun too, because it's not directly business, right? It's baseball thinking about it analytically like you would operating a business.
Business bio of Oprah? Why is there no movie about Oprah's career?
Oh, I mean, probably when she gets a little old. I think she's still too in the public eye. Like, you need to wait a few more years for her to be less present, and then you do the Oprah movie.
Howard Stern, Private Parts is a pretty good business movie. It might not have enough to it, but it
we could
is
definitely
a...
do that.
That's an interesting one.
There was... it's on Prime Video now. There is a really good movie called The Burial that came out this year with Jamie Foxx and Tommy Lee Jones, based on a real lawsuit from the 90s where a small mortuary owner took on like one of these huge funeral service conglomerates in court. And Jamie Foxx plays this kind of ambulance chasing TV defense lawyer who ends up representing the small business. Tommy Lee Jones is the owner of the small business. Really well done, like kind of a throwback courtroom drama, but really well done. And it does touch on a lot of the kinds of, like David versus Goliath kind of stories. Like it's an interesting one to check out as well. I think
Boiler Room comes to mind. Moneyball comes to mind.
Boiler
the Big
Room,
Short
great. Yeah.
would be iconic.
Did I see Margin Call on here? That's a good one too.
Yeah. I mean,
that's an indie about the financial crisis. Like
feel like The Big Short is a bad one because it kind of does that to itself in the movie, right? They have those cutaways where they're like explaining everything.
Yeah. I almost feel like Margin Call is the more interesting take that fewer people have seen.
Mm.
Margin Call
is
like
amazing.
48 hours behind the scenes at Lehman Brothers, like the day that their analysts figured out that the entire market was about to collapse.
I think it's actually Goldman, because Goldman was the one who sold and survived. Lehman was the one that went under. Yeah,
you're right. It's Goldman.
Yeah, it's amazing. Jeremy Irons, greatest movie speech
Jeremy
maybe ever.
Jeremy Irons, Zachary Quinto.
Incredible, The goal of this is to get business lessons out of it. And this one had so many business lessons.
Yeah.
I mean, we could go like
totally
off the...
I do feel like Moneyball has a lot of good ones.
That's why I think Moneyball's got a lot of business lessons. Yeah.
What does Jeremy Irons say? It's you could either be
willing buyers.
There's three ways to get ahead in this business. You can be first, you can be the smartest, or you can cheat. We don't cheat. And I'd like to think we have a lot of smart people in this room, but it's a hell of a lot easier to be first. That's like the big thing when he decides to sell. It's amazing.
All right. This has been amazing. Great job, Lon. Our Twitter handle, our X handle is TWI Startups. And let us know which business breakdown you want next.